Good afternoon. We'll call the Senate Resources Committee meeting to order on February 29th, 2012. Let the record reflect it is approximately 3:34 p.m. on this Wednesday, February 29th. The entire committee is with us today, and present co-chair Senator Wagner, Senator Stedman, Senator Stevens, Senator McGuire, Senator French, Senator Wilikowski, and myself, Senator Paskvin. Today at the hearing, we are joined again, and we welcome PFC Energy. According to their website, quote, PFC Energy is a global consulting firm specializing in the oil and gas industry. Our clients are oil and gas operators, national oil companies, service companies, investors, governments, and other stakeholders, close quote. PFC Energy presented testimony focusing mainly on progressivity to the Senate Resources Committee on February 16th and 17th. Subsequently, the committee requested additional information and modeling, and we are pleased that Janik and today Jerry were able to join us today, as well as with Ashley. And the committee acknowledges that a significant amount of information was requested from them, and we very much appreciate the very prompt turnaround time on and the completion of the amount of work that was completed in time for today's hearing. So we welcome back to Mr. Janik Mayer, and we also welcome Jerry Kappas. And so if the two of you would please introduce yourself on the record, and we have the charts in front of us, so the floor is PFC Energy's.
Okay, thank you. I'll start. My name is Gerald Kappas. I'm a partner for PFC Energy and I'm head of our upstream and gas. I've been in the oil and gas business for about 30 years. I hope that I don't look like that, but it's been a little while. So we are delighted to be here, both appearing today in front of you, senators, and also doing this work because we think this is important work. I know you know that, but I want you to know that we understand that as well. So we're prepared to talk to and respond to any questions that you senators would have about this, as any other follow-on inquiry. So we'll be candid, brief in our comments as you wish. But again, we're happy to go on at length also as you wish. So pleased again for you to have us appear before you.
And just as I could interject, as is the practice of the Senate, we like to introduce elected officials that are in the audience, and we welcome Senator Giesel. And throughout the presentation, I may briefly interrupt just to announce that an elected official has joined us in the audience. So, but please continue.
Thank you.
Thank you. I am Janik Mayer, a manager in PFC Energy's upstream and gas practice, and I'm very pleased to join you once again to continue some of the analysis from before, and in particular move on to similar forms of analysis looking at CSSB 192 and some of the amendments that have been put forward in this committee and what they look like using a similar framework for analysis as we were using last time that we were here. If I start with some of the issues that were brought up in where we left off in our last presentation, a number of the numbers and analysis that were used in our previous presentation used this sort of generic low-cost fuel development as a way of starting to understand what the ACES regime looks like for such development and what it looks like at a range of different possible price decks, in particular to illustrate what overall government take looks like when one looks across the life cycle of a project and what government take looks like at different price decks, how progressivity changes that over the course of the price deck. We had a number of questions at that time about the cost assumptions that were being used for that generic low-cost fuel development. I wanted to provide those here if I could. Those are $10 per flowing barrel in operating expenditures, $5 per flowing barrel in initial development capital spending, another $5 per flowing barrel in ongoing maintenance or renewal capital spending, And then $7.40 per flowing barrel in transportation costs. These are numbers that from our own research, particularly on what costs have been, for instance, at Prudhoe Bay in the most recent financial year that we have data for, are not dissimilar. In fact, in total, if one includes both the initial capital development and the ongoing capital spend, actually somewhat higher. It's important to understand that in some ways the idea behind this sort of generic low-cost reference field was in some ways a hybrid reference case. On the one hand, an actual Prudhoe Bay obviously depreciated its capital a long time ago, but has relatively high, on the order, as we say, of about $5 per flowing barrel, maintenance capex ongoing to replace old facilities to do new well work. And the idea of this low-cost field development was that it was something that would enable us to present life cycle economics, including some initial relatively low upfront development cost, but also show the impact, particularly through capital credits and those sorts of things, of the ongoing maintenance capital that is a key characteristic of an aging field. In addition, one of the things we wanted to be able to present to you today is a look at what this fiscal regime looks like in a different scenario, which is of quite a high-cost field development, one where that initial development capital spend is about three times what we were looking at in the low reference case, so about $15 per barrel of reserves in initial capital spending, and very high operating costs, $17 per flowing barrel in operating costs. And these are costs from some of the recent work we've been doing engaging with some of the companies involved that we feel quite confident are quite close to what we've seen in recent high-cost developments that have actually occurred. Precisely because ongoing capital is treated somewhat preferentially under the system because of the capital credit, we've included a small amount of ongoing maintenance capex, but precisely because the idea here is to look at a high-cost new development, there's not a lot of maintenance capex in here because there isn't in a new development. What there is largely operating cost on a forward and ongoing basis. And in particular, the reason we wanted to look at this higher-cost case is this is, after all, what marginal additional production on the North Slope increasingly looks like. It's important to understand what the ACES regime looks like for a Prudhoe Bay-type development over a life cycle, because that's what the majority of production is. But it's as important and possibly more important in some ways to understand what it looks like for a high-cost development, because for new developments, for things that will replace the barrels lost through decline, the economics look in many ways even harder. And it's important to start to show that picture in what we show here. If I start then, these are essentially the same slides we showed last time. You may notice a change of 1 to 2 percentage points upward in government take. This is a result of a revision made to the model to improve the accuracy of one of the things that we were calculating. But it's a change that has overall a relatively minor impact on the figures that we see here. We just wanted to be quite transparent and make sure that was clear. What we see is around 75% government take at the $100 level, 84% government take at the $230 level. If we compare that with the next slide, which is the high-cost development, what we see is that, and it's useful to think of it this way, that while ACES is in fact highly progressive when it comes to price, and that's something we're all very familiar with, something we've talked about quite a lot. When we were last here, one of the things we also talked about was that regimes could be progressive in different regards. And in particular, could be progressive in regard to price, could be progressive in regard to economic rent, could be progressive in regard to cost. And one of the things that suddenly becomes apparent by looking at this analysis of, well, what does this same model show us for a high-cost development, is that ACES, while it's highly progressive on price, is actually not progressive at all when it comes to cost, and in some ways actually very slightly the opposite. And that seems at first sight like a counterintuitive insight, particularly when one thinks, well, this is a profit-based system. Surely a profit-based system.
Senator French.
I'm sorry. Which page are we on? Oh, here we go.
Slide 4.
Beg your pardon. Very good. Just wanted to make sure I was there. Yep, slide 4. Yep. It's in four. Sorry to interrupt.
One thinks surely a profit-based system inherently must at least be neutral with regard to cost. And if we look at this in a little more detail, what we see is that production tax by itself is in fact slightly progressive with regard to cost. Were it not for the capital credits, it would probably be about neutral. Capital credits make the production tax component slightly progressive with regard to cost, but it's not sufficiently progressive with regard to cost to overcome the inherent regressivity of the other parts, components of the system, particularly the fixed royalty. So what that means is that when we look at government take numbers for a high-cost development, not only are they not lower than they were for the low-cost development, but in fact, at least on these assumptions, they're very slightly higher. And that's important to understand when one then starts to look at what the impact of those high costs are on how economic a project is and what it can do to things like break-even pricing, which we will look at very shortly. So if we look at this, for instance, one of the pieces of analysis that we showed last time was this sort of sensitivity of notional project NPV for a reference field over a range of different prices. And what we were focused on last time was that yellow low-cost field line and looking at the way it bends around and the question of being how does ACES reduce upside for all companies in high-price environments. And so we saw, yes, what progressivity does here is it bends that curve around and reduces net present value for the project to a greater degree as oil prices rise. What's particularly instructive, though, is when we look at this not for the high price field, but for not for the low cost field, but for the high cost field, because when we undertake that analysis, the question of where that progressivity at taking away value at higher costs occur is no longer suddenly this question of, well, there's a lot of economic rent up there at $200 a barrel and more of that's being taken away to the state. It becomes a question of, well, let's look at what's happening here around the $70, $80, $90, $100 mark. Because in this case, for instance, based on these costs, this would be a development that would really only break even in the $90 to $100 range. When I say break even, this is a 10% rate of discount rate used on that NPV. So it would, in fact, only achieve a 10% rate of return in those prices. On the other hand, and if we think back again to some of the analysis we were looking at last time, what that curve looks like when it's much straighter because there is significantly less progressivity. That question of progressivity in this higher cost example can be the difference between a break-even price in the 70s and 80s versus a break-even price in the 90s and above. And I think that's quite a crucial point to understand as one thinks about progressivity and particularly about the impact of high marginal rates under ACES and the impact that they have. The slope of that line, the increasing curvature, the flatter that line is a reflection of high marginal take. And so in that sense, in particular, that line is sort of flattest here between the, I don't know, $70 to $90, $100 mark. And it's the flattening of that line because of high marginal take that in this case is taking a notional break-even for this generic example project from the 70s and 80s and moving it up to the 90s and the 100s. So I think that's an important point to understand.
Just for purposes, we've stated this before, but the viewing public, the documents, if they are not on BASIS yet, they will be on BASIS immediately following this hearing so that the public can have access to that. Anyone that's in the audience, obviously we had copies of these documents outside in the hallway, just so that people, I understand sometimes when they're following documents, it gets complex, but we're now we were on page 5 and I believe soon transitioning to page 6, just so that the public can have an opportunity to make sure that they're following.
Finally, as a recap of sort of the previous analysis that was done, we were also asked to take that analysis away and use Department of Revenue financial year 2013 average estimated costs in it to show what the analysis looked like with those costs. The first thing to understand when using costs like that, which are not about the life cycle economics of a given project, but about a particular snapshot in time of an overall average for all production, is that the mode of analysis that one takes has to then change from instead of being across time, across an economic life cycle, to instead just looking at one specific year. In doing that, there are a number of things that don't get captured. In particular, for instance, things like the sort of bracket creep effects that occur because of the impact of inflation over time, and simply by restricting the analysis to that 1 year, will inherently, as a result, reduce levels of government take that one sees, because one is looking just at that 1 year, not out into the future as well. And one is, of course, no longer looking at the life cycle of an asset type, but rather just at this snapshot and an overall average. We've taken the Department of Revenue forecast figures there and used them in the model. We've used them on a per-flowing barrel basis rather than the per-taxable barrel basis that you may be more familiar with seeing them in from the revenue sources book.
Senator Stedman has a question.
Yes. Want to just explain that a little bit more, Mr. Chairman, if they could?
Certainly. In particular, Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, the Revenue Sources Handbook, the appendices to that particular page 104, D1C, is the financial year 2013 Department of Revenue tax estimate using this methodology. You'll see, for instance, in particular, for operating and lease expenditures here, a figure of 1375 for OPEX, a figure of 1536 for capital expenditures. Those are not those are per barrel prices, but they are not per barrel produced. They are so-called per taxable barrel, meaning that we've taken the entire costs for North Slope production, but taken out royalty barrels, taken out barrels that are from federal or for other reasons don't come under the system, and said slowly, well, what are these costs spread over the taxable barrels? To use these figures as an input to the model, we need to understand what they actually are on a per barrel produced, because that calculation will then be equalized in the course of processing this through the model and taking out the things that get deducted as the model works. If we look then at how this appears using the Department of Revenue figures, we no longer have the life cycle economics in the top left quadrant, since we're no longer looking at that basis. Instead, what I've provided here is a table of actual figures. So looking at the different components of the regime, not from a percentage government take perspective, but from the perspective of actual numbers of revenues from each of these sources. If we look, for instance, at $110 oil, we'll see a production tax number there of $4.78 billion, slightly higher than the $4.717 we see in the financial year 2013 estimates from Department of Revenue. That difference is entirely due to their using a $109.47 barrel price for ANS crude versus a 110. If we use that same price, we get exactly the same result to within a rounding error. The next important thing to say about this, of course, is this, along with the other analyses, but it's a particularly important point to make with regard to this one, is an analytical exercise in saying, if we hold everything else, including costs, constant, what does this system look like at different price decks? of course, what we know to be the case is that as prices have risen historically, so very dramatically have risen costs. And this is a key point to understand and something that we will be looking to get into in a lot more detail as we go further through the analytical exercise that we're undertaking for LBNA committee and present the results of some of those at a later date. But it's important to understand in that sense that just because a given figure is shown at $200 oil doesn't imply that that would actually be the revenue in that case. This isn't a forecast in that sense. It's simply an analytical exercise that says, given this base set of assumptions which match, for instance, what you see in your Department of Revenue analyses, what would this also look like at different price deck levels?
Is that saying that if the prices went up, costs could go up, but you've kept the cost constant
exactly.
At the FY13 levels adjusted for the flowing barrels?
That's exactly correct, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
And you know that costs will go up if that does happen on a sustained basis, as we've seen.
Okay. We're now on, I believe, page 8.
We are now indeed, Mr. Chairman, on page 8. On the overview of CSSB 192 and the amendments that we have in the time frame available been able to analyze as part of this exercise. Those are, of course, the base CS. We then have two amendments. I've grouped these not in numerical order, but rather conceptually. On the left-hand side of the screen, along with ACES, we have a series of non-bracketed systems. On the right, we have two amendments which instead use a bracketed approach to determining production tax. And summaries of the salient points of each. Of course, under ACES, we have a production tax system which is level until $30 a barrel. Progressivity kicks in then at that $30 barrel rate at a 0.4% level and is then reduced to a 0.1% level once production tax value reaches $92.50. Under CSSB 192, there are two key changes that are made. One is putting in a 60% maximum for production tax value rather than the 75% maximum that occurs under the existing system, and the other is a reduction in the initial progressivity coefficient from 0.4% to 0.35%. Amendment B3 similarly uses that 60% maximum, but it doesn't change the 0.4% progressivity coefficient. Amendment B18 similarly uses the 60% maximum. It keeps the 0.4% progressivity coefficient up until a production tax value level of $67.50 per barrel, and then reduces that to the 0.35 level for those prices in between $67.50 and $92.50. That summarizes, I think, the non-bracketed amendments that we've looked at here. There are then two bracketed amendments, which similarly take the 25% base level that applies in all of these cases to production tax value, similarly takes the $30 mark as the level at which progressivity kicks off, but instead uses a bracketed approach to approaching the question of progressivity, going up in, I think, $12.50 increments, adding at each point a given percentage level to incremental value produced above the bracket level. Under Amendment B4, that bracketed system tops out at a maximum level of 60%, common with the non-bracketed amendments that we've seen. Under Amendment B5, that bracketed approach tops out at a maximum of 50%. Those are the amendments that we have analysed in today's presentation. Having started earlier by looking at the question of, well, if we take the high-cost development example that we were using and say, well, what does that do to break-even prices? And as we've seen in this particular example, it pushes a 10% level break even, way up to into the $100 roughly a barrel range. What was interesting to me in looking at this, as we've seen, that's a function of high marginal takes under the ACES system. If we look at these different amendments using this mode of analysis, we notice a couple of things. We notice that the base CS, along with amendment B8 and B18, look, relatively speaking, fairly similar to each other here. There are some gaps between those lines, but they're relatively small. We notice that the significant difference between those and ACES occurs at higher dollar per barrel oil prices, and is an increasing difference, of course, as those prices get greater, and that is simply, of course, a function of the 60% cap, and that being where the divergence occurs. At oil prices more in the $80 to $100 range, while again there will be some differences between them, because, for instance, of the slightly lower progressivity coefficient under CSSB 192, those differences are relatively minor, and the shift that we see in break-even economics for this example project, there is a shift, but it's a relatively small one compared to that which we see, for instance, when we look at the two bracketed amendments, where the result of the bracketing is to significantly reduce the marginal government take because of the bracketing, and that in turn straightens up that line and significantly reduces break-even prices for the high-cost development example. From here, Mr. Chairman, Senators, we have a substantial deck of slides looking at each of these in some detail. We have results for each of these using the low-cost development example, we have results using the high-cost development example, and we have results using the FY 2013 numbers. If you would like, I can step through all of them, and we can see how we go for time. If there is a particular area in which people would like me to focus, we can focus on that. I will take direction from the chairman if I could.
The chimes are ringing, so we have 1 hour left to go. So how, you know, I defer to some extent to your estimation on how long it would take to get through approximately another two dozen slides. So,
if
we've already done it, let's continue then through the low-cost development example.
We're on page 10.
Page 10, exactly. We can, having gone through the low-cost development example, we can look briefly at the high and the FY 2013 numbers. Since ultimately this is an exercise in comparison between different regimes, while there will be differences in numbers between those three cases, the comparisons within each example field, whether it be the high cost, the low cost, or the FY 2013 numbers, are comparable across the range. And so the differences and distinctions we see between the amendments in any given case are largely similar, even if the actual percentage numbers are going to be different depending on the cost estimates that are used behind the analysis. Excuse me.
And just, Mr. Chairman, Senator French, just to remind folks, the low-cost field development assumptions are 10 plus 5 plus 5 plus 7, that's the total.
That's correct. The 5 plus 5 are not strictly additive in any given year because the initial 5 occur during development and on a per reserves basis. The maintenance 5 is every year after production start, but yes, that's correct.
So how do you, just maybe just another word or two on how, before we get too deep into these, how you plug in the reserves CapEx?
Mm-hmm. So the idea is to say, if over the economic lifespan of this asset, this is the total amount that will be produced, where if I look in a given year at what operating costs are going to be, and I'm doing those on a per flowing barrel basis, I can say, in this given year, this is what's going to be produced, this many dollars a barrel. To say, well, what is my initial development capital going to be? I can't look at a given year's production. The best way to estimate that is to say, well, the size of the development is indicated to me by the total reserves that are going to be recovered here. So instead of taking each year's production, I'm taking the sum of each of those years' production and saying, so in total they're comparable, but one is about the initial act of development, which occurs before any production has occurred, and one is about an amount based on a given year's production.
That helps me understand it. Thank you. I just want to make sure. So it's taking into account everything you spent to get the first barrel out of the ground. Is that a more sort of straightforward way to say it?
Yeah, that's the initial development capital. And then it depends on different types of developments, but you could foresee a development where 8 years after production startup, you may need to redrill some wells, or you're drilling additional wells to increase the recovery factor, which wasn't quite what you thought it was, et cetera. In this case, because the low-cost development is effectively older fields, we've smeared out these additional development costs annually, and you see kind of a uniform pattern, which wouldn't necessarily be the case with a brand-new field development. So that has been called renewal capital or maintenance capital. You might be replacing pipelines, redrilling wells, what have you, which is essentially what's happening in the North Slope right now for these fields.
But, Senator, if you look at the cash flow graph, perhaps the easiest way of explaining it is to say that initial big yellow dip at the bottom that occurs before any production has occurred is the development capex calculated on a per barrel reserves basis. The ongoing yellow line is the maintenance capital calculated on a flowing barrel basis. And if, while their shape over time is different, because each is $5 per barrel, they will add up to the same amount in total.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
One other thing to notice, which is that, in fact, if you look at the dip of that, of those yellow bars, which is the development capital, and then the black line, which is the after-tax cash flow for the project, you'll notice the after-tax cash flow is not as significantly negative in those early years as the capex would suggest it might be. That, of course, is the impact of the credits under ACES that provide some relief to the producer in those early years, and that's an important thing to understand about the system and the way ACES works.
And I think that worth pointing out that so that the viewing audience understands what is, I believe, just been stated, is that Alaska, because of its capital expenditure credits at the early stage of the product, Alaska is front-end loading those costs by a certain percentage, and so over those initial development phase, that's Alaska's contribution towards the project, and then once production starts, then the black line goes positive to the state.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And in this case, positive to the partner that is undertaking the project. But, yes, that's entirely correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
So the slide that we have in front of us, slide 10, ACES in the low-cost development environment, is one that we're familiar with, saw earlier today, and have seen in the previous analysis presented before this committee. If we now take that and compare it with what CSSB 192 looks like using the same low-cost development field, we notice a couple of things. In particular, if we're looking at things like total levels of government take, where the significant difference starts to occur is, of course, from the sort of $140, $150 a barrel level upward, which is essentially, in that sense, where the 60% progressivity cap starts to make a difference in the total level of government take. So where before total government take really kept climbing all the way through to $230 a barrel, reaching a sort of maximum around the 84% level in the previous example, in this example it reaches 79 or so percent, 79 to 80% at that 140, 150 level, and then stays largely constant after that. There is a slight difference earlier on in that at lower price levels we may see, for instance, around a 1% or so decrease in government take compared to the previous example. That comes from the lower progressivity coefficient that's being applied, being the 0.35% progressivity coefficient rather than the 0.4% progressivity coefficient.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you do you have the dollar numbers there by chance for say 100, the difference between ACEs and the CS at 100 in the range from 100 to say 130, which is sort of where we're expecting oil to be in the next.
If you would like to turn significantly further ahead in your slide deck to slide 23, that slide 22 and 23. 22 is what ACES looks like using the financial year 2013 Department of Revenue inputs looking just at that 1 year. And slide 23 is what CSSB 192 looks like on that basis.
And for purposes of the record, for the people that are in the audience physically here today, a list of the amendments has been placed on a table in the hallway, so if anyone needs to get the actual list of amendments. Mm-hmm. And for those that are viewing by television or the internet, the master list of those amendments is also posted on BASIS. So everyone has access to that list.
Over $100 million.
So to use the $110 example, since that's closest to the numbers used in the Department of Revenue figures, in the ACES case, that equates to, I think, $4.78 billion versus under CSSB 192, that equates to about $4.512 billion.
Okay, that's short.
So if I could, Mr. Chair, so just looking at sort of where we've been in the last week or so, we've had oil at 100 and between 120 and 130. So the state take is what I'm looking at. We're going from $9.952 billion to $9.96. That's roughly $300 and change million at 120, if I'm correct, and then 130, it's about almost $450 million. Is that about right?
That certainly sounds about right to me.
Different amendments if we pronounce the full, the required info by all terms.
We will, if we may, now step back to the original.
Other way.
If we go from looking at...
Just for purpose of the record, what page?
Moving from slide 11, where we had been, through to slide 12 now. If we go from looking at the base CS to looking at the first amendment that we're looking at here, that is Amendment B8 from Senators Wilkowski and French, the Simple Progressivity Amendment. The effect that we see from 140 to 150 onward on overall levels of government take here is, of course, largely similar to that we see in the previous example, and that is because the cause of that change is exactly the same as the cause of the change in CSSB 192, which is simply the cap being set at 60% progressivity. Below the level at which that cap binds, we should find levels of government take that are essentially identical to the ACES system, because, of course, unlike Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192, Amendment B8, simple progressivity, doesn't have the change in progressivity coefficient from 0.4 to 0.35. If we look instead at Amendment B18, we see something that in many ways lies in between the impact of CSSB 192 and Amendment B8. That is to say, again, similarly above that $140-$150 level, we see the 60% maximum start to bind, and therefore levels of government take flatten out at that point. We see a slighter effect earlier in the price deck. And that is because, of course, in a more limited range of prices under this amendment, there is also a reduction in the progressivity coefficient from 0.4 to 0.35. But that reduction doesn't occur for all prices between $92.50 and $30, but instead only occurs above the $67.50 production tax value level. And that is what accounts for the differences in that case. If we move on to slide 14 and look at Amendment B4 from Senator Maguire, progressivity bracketed with a 35% top bracket, what we see here is immediately a significantly greater reduction in overall levels of government take. At the top end, for instance, these come down from the 84% we were seeing under ACES, 79% that we were seeing under Committee Substitute for Senate Bill 192, down in this case to about 75% level, which is a result of the fact that while the maximum has still been set at that 60% level, the effect of bracketing is to bring down levels of government take across the entire price deck. If we move on and look at Amendment B5, we see again something similar, but it's lower still because of the lower maximum that has been set, in this case a maximum of 50% under Amendment B5, the progressivity bracketed with a 25% top bracket, or 50% maximum for total production tax value. So in this case, the highest levels of government take we see under this example are around 71%. We can step through these if people would like for a high-cost development. In general, as I say, the impacts are going to be similar in each case, just with slightly different absolute numbers because of the different cost assumptions. I suspect there may be particular questions if we were to step on to the FY 2013 numbers that people have, for instance, about particular revenue estimates that come from that, and that might may be a more interesting question for the committee, but I will be guided by the chairman if I could.
Senator Olakowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just on the corporate income tax, are you assuming payment of the full 9.4%, or are you assuming some lower?
We assume 8.4, which from previous research that we had undertaken led us to believe was a reasonable average for the state of Alaska, but we are by no means expert in the intricate details of Alaska state income tax.
If it were a couple percentage points less than that, would that have a how much?
It would have an impact. It would be a very small impact. For instance, if we look at the contribution of state corporate income tax to overall government take, because, of course, what one is measuring, A, the questions of deductibility from other forms of tax, and B, in particular, the fact that 8.5%, 9.5% income tax that we're talking about is on taxable income, not on divisible income, which, of course, is what government take is calculated on. We see something that ranges from 0 to 2% of the total. So if that were slashed in half, for instance, we might lose a percentage in government take, but it's not going to make a dramatic difference.
Thank you. Slightly different area, but is there a sort of a creative way, because when we cut production taxes, we're giving a fairly large chunk to the federal government. Is there some sort of creative way that you can cut something and
maybe cut? Don't tell anybody.
Well, another dial, another lever to pull that wouldn't result in giving it back to the federal government. Maybe gave that back to the producers instead of giving it back to the federal government.
Senator Wilkoski, I don't have an immediate answer to that question, but I will happily take it on advisement if I may.
Possibly it would be a good point. You were talking about the percentage of total government take when one references the state income tax, but the federal income tax, what is your base assumption, and is it, you know, the 35%, and what percentage of the total government take is federal income tax? And then what we've also heard is potentially that the actual rate paid is substantially less than the 35%. So possibly if you could walk us through the similar analogy that you did on the state income tax.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. In this case, in the model, the model does use the nominal 35% effective rate. Again, if we look at the contribution of federal corporate income tax to total government take, that range that will vary between 8% up to maybe 12-13% in the highest cases in terms of the contribution it makes to total government take. So a substantial reduction in that could take a percentage point or two, maybe even three, for instance, off the total government take figures that we see here, but I would be very surprised to see it take more than that off.
Is it a question about going from 35% to 28%, which is the latest proposal, or?
No, it's about effective rates.
Yeah, effective. Right. So, yeah,
no, an effective tax rate. Okay. In other words, there's been information that it may be 15%, certainly
right.
Under 20%. And so just to give the members of the committee a general understanding of what, and also on page 16 and in other charts, there is a federal, what they call CIT, corporate income tax, and that rate is set forth at the various cost structures for the price of a barrel of crude. And
got it. Understood.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just while we're on the subject of some of the numbers, on the state property tax, did you, there's communities that have first call on the 20 mils, and then there's the part that comes back to the state. Here you're showing 93 million, but there's probably about 400 and some million in total property tax. So why would you not take care of, count all of the property tax paid by the industry, regardless of who it goes to, the state or one of the particular boroughs or cities, in that process?
Senator Stedman, thank you for the question. That may indeed be something that we need to look at and understand in greater detail than we have until this point.
That's fine.
Mr. Chairman, should we move ahead to
please,
FY 2013?
40 minutes to go, so...
We move through the high-cost developments to the FY 2013 numbers.
I believe
we will find on page 22.
22.
If we'd go through these quite briefly, but please by all means interrupt with questions at any point. We go under ACES at the $110 level from an estimated $4.78 billion to $4.512 billion under CSSB 192. We get something almost indistinguishable from ACES at that price level, of course, for Amendment B8, the reason being, again, that Amendment B8 doesn't have the impact of the lower progressivity coefficient, and the reduced cap doesn't bind at that price level.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
If we could maybe, I guess we're on 24. Could we back up to 22?
Yes.
22 is our current system, and one of the things we've talked about here, even though I see you don't have the discussion points here, was the impact at lower prices on the state of Alaska. And can, on the lower chart here to the lower right-hand side, could you explain the submersion of the yellow bar underneath the y-axis?
Certainly, Senator Stedman, thank you for the question. In the $40 case, in this case, you will see that there is negative production tax value. That occurs and will occur in low oil price environments for almost any project. Where in the price tag occurs, of course, will depend on project economics. The reason it occurs is because at that price level, the project as a whole is probably no longer profitable. Certainly, it no longer generates production tax value. So before capital credits and other credits, its production tax liability is zero. Over and above that, however, if the project is spending capital, it accrues a 20% capital credit that is reimbursable regardless of the fact that there is no production tax liability against it. And so in that case, the effective production tax after capital credits have been included is negative in that instance. Now, an important thing to understand, however, is that in this case, for example, while it's negative at $40 a barrel, it's the overall level of government take and state government take is still very high because, again, of the regressive nature of things like royalty. So, for instance, while there is a negative payment from on the production tax side, there is still significant royalty revenue coming in from the project, which is greater in this instance than that negative payment, and which probably consumes almost the entirety of the cash flow from that project.
If I can, Mr. Chairman, so then looking at our tables, and it's hard, I think, for the people to see on the screen, but at $40 a barrel, the government takes 112%. So could then I infer that under the current system, at $40 price, we have a 112% government take?
That is simply in that sense because the divisible income from the project isn't enough to cover all of the taxes that are paid on it. In particular, for instance, I think the best way of visualizing this, Senator, if I may, is to use the example from the last time that I was here where we were looking at the impact of a flat royalty over different projects with different cost structures, and that some, for instance, with very marginal economics, because they had very high costs relative to the oil price, may have the impact of a royalty may in fact be to take up all of the divisible income, or in some cases more than all of the divisible income. That's possible for any project that faces a flat royalty. It's a question of what oil price that occurs at and what its cost structure is.
Good. And just for an explanation, that is because royalty has first call on income stream.
Exactly. It's because royalty is measured on a gross basis before costs and other things are considered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator. Please continue.
So as we saw at the $110 level, Amendment B8 is largely the same as the current system, ACES. There is a slight reduction in the modeled revenue at the $110 level under Amendment B18. The reduction is less than that we saw under CSSB 192. And again, the reason for that is because the reduced 0.35% progressivity coefficient in this case applies only at prices above the $67.5 mark, not to the entire price deck between 30 and 92.5. If we look at Amendment B4, we see forecast revenues at the $110 mark of $3.275 billion and under B5 of a very similar rate. Mm-hmm. Of course, the difference there being that the greater differences occur at points higher in the price deck. If we then move on to slide 28, I wanted briefly, if I could, to draw the committee's attention to questions of average marginal take for each of these systems. As we step through this, there will be two graphs for each of these. The graph in the bottom right looks just at the production tax component of the ACES regime, and the axis on the bottom is looking at that against production tax value. To see what that means, both in terms of the system as a whole and in terms of what it looks like at things that are actual the oil price rather than simply the technical question of production tax value. We have the graph in the upper left, which looks not just at ACES and the particular tax rate that's paid, but on the left-hand axis has a total level of government take, either a marginal rate or an average rate, and what that looks like over the course of the price deck. So, for instance, under ACES, and we've presented this the previous time that we were here in front of the committee, we see relatively high marginal rates going up to the high 80s and low 90s under ACES, peaking, of course, at the $92.5 production tax value, which is where the coefficient goes from being 0.4% to 0.1%. What that means in the context of the system as a whole is that, again, at oil prices in the $110 to $130 range, we see very high marginal rates, and the peak that one sees at that point in the price deck and the overall system is the same peak that one is seeing from production tax value in the bottom right graph. If we look at the impact of CSSB 192 on the next slide, really what it does here is two different things. One, the ramp up, the peak of marginal take under CSSB 192 is a little lower, and the slope going up to it is a little more gradual, and that is, of course, simply a function of the 0.35% progressivity coefficient instead of the 0.4 progressivity coefficient. It still has that same sort of sawtooth profile to it, of course, but it then, for instance, if we look at the production tax value graph, drops down and is equal to the average rate at production tax values of around the $200 to $210 mark, and that is, of course, where the 60% cap on progressivity starts to bind.
Possibly this would be a good time just to explain again to the public, when you're talking PTV, production tax value, the difference between that and the price of oil. So that, you know, we have in the left part of the graph, we have oil price, and the right part of the graph, we have production tax value. Just if you could make sure the public is 100% with you.
Certainly. So production tax value per barrel of oil is a technical concept that underpins the ACES system and that underpins all the systems envisaged by the various amendments. It's a number that is come up with by taking the revenues that come from selling oil, subtracting away the costs, and then dividing them by the total taxable production. So it's essentially the price of a barrel of production after all of the costs that went into producing it have been subtracted away. So if, to use a very simple example, we had precisely $20 of costs routinely, day in, day out, then there would be a $20 difference between production tax value and an oil price.
Thank you. And possibly, you know, many of the members of the listening audience have heard the term effective tax rate. How does that layer on top of all of this?
For the purposes of the analysis we're looking at here, I would say effective and average mean the same thing. The important thing to understand in that context being that the average rate is the rate at any given price level that is actually paid. The marginal rate is the rate that comes when I look at if the price of oil increases by $1 a barrel, how much of that do I get to keep and how much of that goes in tax?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
I think it, Mr. Chairman, I think it'd be nice to point out that we're looking at marginal government take issues, not dealing with the oil price, not the marginal taxes, correct?
My apologies, Senator Stedman, I didn't entirely understand the question.
The chart is average versus marginal government take. Right. On
yes.
the left-hand side, dealing with oil prices, not the effective or marginal tax rate.
That's correct. Both are average versus marginal analyses. The analysis in the top left is of government take over oil over a range of oil prices. The analysis on the bottom right is of the specific tax rate for production tax value over a range of production tax values. Moving on from CSSB 192, if we look at Amendment B8, earlier in the price deck, again, we have exactly the same profile as we had under ACES, with the sole difference, of course, being the second sawtooth here, where the marginal rate comes down in the bottom right graph to the 60% level, which, of course, is where the 60% cap binds. If we look further at Amendment B18, we see a slightly more complex profile of the marginal rate, which, of course, is the impact of the initial 0.4% progressivity coefficient, with a reduction in that progressivity coefficient to 0.35 at somewhere in the $60 range. And marginal tax rates under production tax value still getting up to the 80s, but not quite as high as they were otherwise. And then after that, the same profile as we saw under CSSB 192. If we look, however, at the bracketed systems, what we see is something very different. In particular, we don't get the dramatic peaks in very high marginal, either very high marginal tax rates for the production tax or very high marginal rates of government take, and that is simply the impact of the bracketed approach to calculating these things, meaning that one doesn't get those very high peaks, and as a result, the overall average rises more slowly. In the context of some of the things that we talked about earlier today and that we talked about on the previous occasion that we gave testimony before this committee, that means a number of things. If we move ahead briefly to the final slide, slide 34, we come back once again to that sensitivity of project value over crude prices. Once again, it's the lower levels of marginal take under the bracketed systems that are what is increasing the slope of that line for the two bracketed systems, and that is making a significant difference to, in this case, to project break-even pricing. Secondly, of course, the issue that we discussed last time we gave testimony here is the question of the impact of high marginal rates on what it is that companies spend in their capital budget, and in particular, the question that I think has been much discussed here now of gold plating, and the question of whether, when one faces a very high marginal tax rate, there may be incentives to spend more on a given project than one might otherwise, simply because the high marginal tax rate means that effectively the share of additional spending that one has to bear oneself is relatively low. To go back one slide to page 33, we'll finish up simply by pointing out that Amendment B5, of course, looks a lot like Amendment B4, but of course, the peak of the marginal rate and the average rate that follows it is instead to look at the production tax rate at 50% rather than at 60%, and correspondingly, we see a peak marginal rate well under 80% in the case of Amendment B5.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. If I might, through the chair, just go back to your last point that you made about marginal taxation. And said another way, Pedro talked to us about the concept of efficiency mm-hmm. in projects. So you talked about gold plating and the tendency for companies to want to do that when there is when the marginal rates go up. So said another way, would you describe it as inefficiencies get built into the system?
Certainly that it's possible that there may be perverse incentives under systems with a high marginal rate, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions of PFC Energy?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask if it's perverse relative to the Treasury. I assume that's what you meant.
And relative to the question of efficiency also. Yeah.
I do have a couple more, just if I might. So I think one of the things we've talked about here in the committee is the fact that we do offer credits in sort of an unusual way. We forward fund them, and we don't force companies to carry them, to carry them forward into their tax liability, whereas some systems do that. And I just would like an opinion from you. Australia is one example of a country that does offer a lot of credits, but they force the companies to carry them forward and then ultimately deduct them. We actually allow the companies to turn in those credits essentially for cash, which has been a hit on the Treasury. And I think one of the arguments that comes up where people say, well, we might have high progressivity, but look what we're paying out in terms of our credits. So just an opinion from you about whether or not Alaska would be better off to lower its progressivity rate and perhaps correct what it's doing with respect to credits. I just don't know if you've gotten a chance to look at it and either reduce the amount or at least force them to be carried forward against the actual tax liability to build more efficiency into the system.
Sure. This is certainly, I think, a pivotal issue that both this committee and the legislature as a whole needs to grapple with. It's something that we've been doing a lot of research and analysis on precisely for that reason. We are still in the process of doing that research and analysis. I would anticipate that in a number of weeks and certainly as we appear later in the session before Senate Finance, we will have some recommendations to make in that regard. We aren't at the process in our own analytical exercise yet to make firm recommendations on that question.
And if I just two more, if I might, Mr. Chairman. So as you come back to I'm on the Finance Committee, so I look forward to hearing from you gentlemen then. So I would like to hear an analysis. I know you don't have time to go into every fiscal system that's out there, but Australia is one I throw out to you about whether or not Alaska would be more competitive if we lowered the progressivity rate and adjusted the way we do credits, and then where would that sweet spot be in your opinion? And then finally, any information you have about whether companies look at these credits, how they make their decisions. I think that's one of the things we're struggling with here is a measure of that competitiveness. When companies are looking at their spending, it's clear on their testimony indicates that they're not looking at Alaska as a place they'd like to invest. It's not competitive for them. But are they factoring in credits? And so it seems to me, at least, that our generous program of credits don't seem to be factoring in, but I'd like to hear any testimony from you about whether you've seen them factor them in other jurisdictions or why we're missing that piece.
I think we do intend to spend more time on that. I would say for right now, though, I think they do factor them in.
Okay.
And I think they also take them as a signal of the government's or state's intent in terms of, you know, what kind of investment climate that they want. So the question I think would be, and I think we're right at the point in terms of our project here where we're going to start to be able to shed some light on these issues, is how does that interact with other parts of the fiscal structure, which is your question really. And what role does that play? It may be that the credit structure that you have is incenting investments in part of the possibly the production base, but not in terms of new projects per se. So I know that doesn't sound like a very straightforward answer, but but that's probably what we're looking at, and we'd like to get a little bit further down the road here so we can be more specific for you.
Excellent. Thank you.
I will add one thing to that, if I may, which is I've brought up on the screen slide 16, which was looking simply at the ACES regime using the high-cost development as an example, to once again point out the reason the economics of a project that looks like this are particularly challenged is just because of the very high upfront capital cost that goes with that. That is certainly somewhat ameliorated in this case by the 20% capital credit. The problem is that it's not sufficiently ameliorated in that sense to make up for the overall challenge measure of the economics.
If you didn't have that credit, probably your after-tax cash flow black line would be somewhere down here. And what often these companies look at is how much capital are they out at any one year? So for in some respects for them, this is, you might call it a risk mitigator. And so the question is, if in any given locale, I'm not talking about Alaska, but if they're out, $2.3 billion at peak before they can get a project on stream, then that's a risk metric for them. And obviously, that's something they don't want to be doing in Ecuador. But it is something that they, would feel better about doing it in a place like Alaska. So it does have an impact, and it comes in at places just like that.
When you another way of saying risk mitigator, that means Alaska is attractive in that regard to the extent of its credits.
Yes, I think if you compare Alaska and Ecuador, Alaska is more attractive than in Ecuador from a number of different reasons, not just because of you folks here. So,
and Senator French had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe you could go back to slide 11 while we're in the area. And that's it. Great. Maybe we could have a little more discussion of what the little tiny little graph is up in the center of the chart about internal rate of return and what it means, and just a little more detail about that.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. So that chart was there to provide, again, an indication of what some very rough project economics look like for this generic low-cost development example across the range of different cases. The numbers are more instructive in terms of comparison between the different fiscal scenarios than they are in their own right, since this isn't an actual project that we're evaluating. But what one can see, for instance, is that if we look at what things look like at the $100 level, we see an increase in the overall project value, that net present value, that being the discounted value today of the future cash flows of the project, from, in this case, $712 million to $756 million. That comes almost entirely as a result, in this case, as a result of the decrease in the progressivity coefficient from 0.4 to 0.35, since at the $100 level, the higher, the 60% cap isn't binding at that level. So that increase in project value comes entirely as a result of the reduced progressivity coefficient.
And talk a little bit about what the 23% figure means for IRR. What does that mean?
Certainly. So internal rate of return is another benchmark metric that is often used in part of the process of project valuation and project approval. It, on the one hand, net present value is something that enables one to get a sense of the absolute level of value of a given project. But it's less useful in comparing very different projects with each other, because it doesn't tell you very much about where the value comes, or in terms of time value of money, or it becomes quite difficult to compare very expensive projects with relatively cheap ones. IRR can be a useful metric in equalizing those and enabling comparison between them. And we've talked before about companies may have particular internal rate of return benchmarks as one first filter in the process of capital allocation, that they may be lower, for instance, in developed countries than in developing countries, that probably at minimum a company would expect to see a 15% rate of return, and in many cases significantly higher as a hurdle, depending on a range of things, including risks involved in the project.
And we've heard that 15% number used before as sort of just a benchmark. I mean, I'm not trying to say it's you know, the number, but it's, you know, it's a rough house sort of way to sort of get a gauge on what's a profitable investment, what's not. And, you know, so 23%, that's good. That's, you know, significantly above 15% for 23% rate of return. What would happen to that IRR if we used $120 as the price? I take it it would keep going up. Can you just sort of roughhouse guess how much more will go up since 120 is about where we are right now?
I wouldn't want to give a precise numerical answer to that, I'm afraid, since it's entirely guessing, but it would be further up into the 20s.
You're a cautious man.
That's a good thing. Yeah.
And would low-cost development, just for my better understanding of how you put this together, would that, you know, for example, be, you know, drilling an infield well at Prudhoe Bay? Something that's sort of done all the time.
I wouldn't want to go so far as to say that somehow these particular figures that you see there apply to that, but that is the general idea. And I think that that's one of the key things to grasp here, is that there are absolutely profitable forms of investment on the North Slope at the moment, and those are going on as we speak. There is capital being spent on the North Slope, but that capital is largely being spent both on renewing and maintaining old facilities that were built to last 25 years and now require significant investment if they're going to keep going, and in sidetracking old wells, in doing a range of well work that this involves a lot of capital that is required to simply go from what would otherwise probably be a 15% decline curve to a 6% decline curve. And there are healthy returns to be had by spending that money, and that's why that money is spent. As soon as one gets away from the established infrastructure that's there, as soon as one starts drilling much more challenging wells into viscous oil reservoirs, if one has to, you know, build a sand island to put one's production facilities on, these things suddenly start costing much, much more money. And when that's the case, you start to see the much more challenged economics we have of the high-cost development example.
And that leads to my next question, unless I'm taking up somebody's time, Mr. Chairman.
Follow-up.
Very good. We talked earlier about, you know, how you might be, for just threw out a number of $2.3 billion out of pocket. We were looking at the dip there before you start seeing the blue bars. It's the yellow bars. It's the total cost before you start seeing some money come back. How could the state, what would happen if the state said, let's just make it $2 billion so it's easier to work with here in the committee. What if the state said you got a $2 billion field you want to develop? And, you know, we've looked at the numbers in your IRRs down there, maybe closer to 15, you know, not quite as attractive. How would the state improve the economics of a field like that if it said, we want to invest with you. We want to put $500 million to work alongside your $2 billion. So we'll take a quarter, you take three quarters.
You mean the state would take an equity stake? In the project?
Yes.
That doesn't actually change the rate of return that we're seeing here. It simply means that rate of return applies both to the private sector partner and to the state.
To the state, yeah. Right.
Because the state is putting in the capital, but it's also taking its share of the cash flows out.
Assuming the state wanted to participate at the exact same rate of return.
But in addition, the state is doing two things. The state is putting in its share of the capital as an equity partner, but it's also taking out its share of the cash flows. And the impact of those two things is neutral.
As an exact equal partner.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you.
Unless the state was willing to pay a promote to the operator in place, and in theory, if you did that, if you said, okay, if it was another company, Chevron or something, coming up and talking to BP and saying, hey, I want to farm into 25% of this, and I'll pay, you know, the $500 million. If they want it badly enough, BP might charge them a promote where Exxon or Chevron would actually pay an additional amount just to enter. So in that case, their rate of return on that could actually be different from that, but that would be the only way.
If the buy-in partner is willing to take a lower rate of return, they can improve the economics for the other entity.
Exactly.
Essentially, yes, that's right.
Thank you.
Senator Wilikowski.
Do you have a sense of the North Slope It seems to me that there are fields which are very lucrative, the legacy fields, relatively low cost, high internal rate of return, high profit margins. But then maybe there's some new exploration which is probably not as lucrative. Can you talk, number one, about the blended portfolio? I know we spent a lot of time talking about this under ACES and how the way ACES is structured, you investing in the high-cost fields actually lowers your tax rates on the low-cost fields as well. Are you familiar with that concept at all?
I am. That's certainly true, that effect occurs. I would say it's a relatively marginal effect. And absolutely, for instance, if we were to look at our hypothetical high-cost development here in the context of an existing portfolio, there may be two things that occur that improve the economics of it compared to what it looks like for a new operator starting from scratch. Those two things are the ability to not only take capital credits for the initial capital spending, but to deduct those from existing production. And the second is, as you say, and I think this is a much more marginal benefit, the question of whether in that process of blending the average rate is reduced. Those are certainly important factors. In a case like this, I think by and large they don't change the fundamentals of the question of very high costs combined with an overall high level government take, making a project very challenging.
And then one other follow-up. And if the policy for the state was to we want to encourage the new developments, the higher cost developments, and there are a few amendments. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at those or not yet. Senator Wagner had one, Senator French and I had one, to provide allocations for, and different ways of doing it, but basically allocations for developing new oil. Mm-hmm. Have you had a chance to look at that?
We have not.
We are aware of them. We've looked at them very briefly. Precisely because they're significantly more challenging to model, we haven't spent our time on them at this point. There are certainly aspects of those regimes, particularly if one is looking not at total government take and total revenue, but what this looks like for a project, if it's a new project versus an existing project, that we can do and that we very much like to do. But we have, in the very limited time available to us, we haven't been able to do that at this point.
Thank you.
You know, one of the questions that's arisen in my mind is, you know, we see these low-cost developments and we're translating that to the legacy fields, yet we look at the fall 2011 revenue source book and we see this figure that's north of $37 for the transportation OPEX and CAPEX. What's, you know, so we get this figure that's $22, but then in the homogenized, you know, fall 2011, we got 37. What's producing that?
Like any process of averages, you have a very wide range of extremes that one is looking at, and by simply looking at a mean, one loses all of the detail and the granularity around that. I think that's a particularly crucial point to understand as we all think about this, because what the economics of ACES looks like is very different for a mature asset that just has enough capital being spent on it to keep it on a particular decline to what it looks like for a brand new high-cost development far from infrastructure. And to the extent that it's the difficult oil that is going to provide incremental barrels to make up for some of the decline, that's what needs to be incentivized through a fiscal system that is not currently happening.
Yeah, if I could say, sorry, I mean, ACES to us, I think, looks like a fiscal structure designed to get maximum out of a harvest area, as opposed to using that into an area that a company would refer to as a growth area. That's all. So, I guess one of the as we've been working on this over the past couple of months and trying to use our experience in many other jurisdictions globally and applying it to here and wrestling with it and building the model to make sure we've captured these nuances here. That is something that kind of jumps out at us in terms of, you know, what is the purpose here? And that is, I would if I just looked at ACEs and its impact, that appears to be the purpose of ACEs for us. So it does one thing very well and other things not so well, if that makes sense.
Very quickly.
Yeah, and exploration credits, how have you looked at the exploration credit aspect of ACEs? And what sort of credits do companies get for new exploration
right. ACEs? Well, we have looked at that. I don't think we had formal testimony prepared for today. We certainly have looked at that. But in truth, we focused on things that would impact the state of Alaska over the next 10 or 12 years from a revenue perspective. So while we did look at that, that has not yet been a primary focus for us.
Well, what's your understanding of what the exploration credits are?
Well, there's a couple of different types. I don't know if you want to get into
that. My understanding is the principal one is the exploration credit, which can be up to 40%.
Yeah. What's the total?
Senator Pastor.
Well, we're at the end, and there's going to be more time for these types of questions, but, you know, we're at the end of our hour. But anyway, I want to thank PFC Energy. You know, we've heard, I believe, some more important evidence here. We've seen low-cost development, high-cost development. We've had a little more refinement to the terms. Average or marginal government take, important concepts. We've seen net present value at a 10% rate of return. We've seen discussion about internal rates of return and then kind of counting the cash at the bottom line to the state of Alaska, what's the effective tax rate. So we've received a lot of important information today over a spectrum of prices, and so I thank PFC Energy for the information that they provided us today. And we look forward to hearing more from PFC Energy in the future. But for today, and one more thing, we will be meeting here at 6 o'clock here for public testimony in 1 hour. So given that, Senate Resources is adjourned.
Thank you.